Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. The customers have spoken, and they are not too happy with some of the major airlines. The annual J.D. Power & Associates Customer Satisfaction Survey shows that ratings for the traditional carriers like U.S. Airways and United dropped a couple of points, while scores for the discount carriers rose for the third year in a row. Overall, passengers seem to like features like smartphone check-in, but hate those baggage fees. Joining us with an update on the industry and a heads up for summer travelers is Wall Street Journal travel editor Scott McCartney, who writes the paper's middle seat column. Scott, welcome back to Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Tracy.
So this survey, something like 13,000 passengers were questioned. Were you surprised by any of the results from this?
No, I don't think so. It's been a difficult time for major airlines in a lot of ways. They've struggled with merger issues. They've struggled with high oil prices, and that's meant a barrage of fees that have angered customers. And, you mix that in with TSA complaints, and travel just isn't a very satisfactory experience these days.
So what do the airlines do with this information? I mean, there's the J.D. Power survey. There's another one, I believe, that recently came out. What happens next? Do the airlines take these surveys and do something with that information?
Well, some play more to J.D. Power and other surveys than others. Airlines do their own internal customer satisfaction surveys. They're far more interested in what their best customers are telling them, so their corporate accounts, their top-level elite frequent flyers. And there's an element of, airlines being caught between a rock and a hard place. They know people hate baggage fees. They know Southwest isn't charging baggage fees. That's a pressure point for them. But at the same time, baggage fees have been the only way they've been able to pass on higher fuel prices to customers. And so, given their druthers, would they rather not charge baggage fees? I think that's probably right. On the other hand, baggage fees have enabled them to, in most cases, make money even among amid high oil prices.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, Scott, because that really was one of the pet peeves, was the baggage fees. What are some of the airlines charging right now for a checked bag? I know it may vary from airline to airline, but give us a ballpark.
Yeah, the standard is basically $25 for the first check bag, $35 or more for the second check bag. Very heavy fees, $50, $100, different airlines for what would be considered overweight bags, which is more than 50 pounds. Take a big suitcase, you can get to 50 pounds real quick.
Real fast, exactly.
And so that's a sort of a gotcha that gets a lot of people. You add it up, and you're looking at, on a round trip for somebody with two bags, $120, and you paid $300 for your ticket, and here comes an extra $120 at the airport. It's a significant difference. People are, I think, getting more savvy about avoiding baggage fees, and that's led to sort of chaos in the boarding process and in the cabin. People know that if they get on quick, they'll find overhead space. The bins fill up quickly because everybody's trying to avoid baggage fees. And so you end up with, standing in the jetway with the anxiety of, now I got to check my bag or give it to the flight attendant and cross my fingers and hope it gets there.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other issue now, these carry-on bags, because, I think about Spirit Airlines wanting to, or I guess they are already charging people for the carry-ons, right? For the things, the bags that go in the bins.
Yeah, and there's actually, as much as Spirit has been beaten up over this, there's actually some logic to what they've done. I don't like it. Lots of people don't like it. But there is some method to their madness in that they're trying to incentivize people to check bags. They know that people are overstuffing the overhead bins. In Spirit's case, because they cram so many seats onto their airplanes, they actually have less overhead bin space per passenger than other carriers. And so they ended up with, 12 or 15 people on a flight standing at the jetway trying to gate check their bag, and that really slowed down their operation. By switching to carry-on fees, where they charge, I think it may be $35 for a carry-on fee, $30 for a checked bag. It's a little bit less to check your bag. So they're trying to encourage people to check bags. They've actually taken minutes out of their schedule, been able to add flights without buying more airplanes. It's a huge economic issue for airlines, this notion of we're going to spend 5 minutes every flight standing there checking bags because the bins are full.
Yeah.
And so the two issues are really intertwined. Southwest sees much the same thing. More of their passengers check bags because it's free. And that speeds up their operation. That's a good thing for the airline.
Well, yeah, and there's nothing worse for passengers than, you know, walking two steps and then having to wait while somebody's, you know, putting their bags in the overhead. And it certainly prolongs the process. But, Scott, didn't the airlines create this situation when they started charging for the check bags? Now you've incented people to try to work around that in some way to the point where you've got people who have these overstuffed bags that maybe they know are not going to fit in the overhead bins, but they figure, hey, you know what, we'll sort it out when we get there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's not just the overstuffed bag. It's the number of bags. It's the people who might have checked a bag had it been free, but decided to carry on the bag, or bring two carry-on bags, or you get one bag plus a personal item. Well, the personal items have ballooned in size, so the airlines have created the problem. They've also created the problem by adding seats to airplanes, and you can't add overhead bin space, so you add an extra row of seats, and even Southwest is doing this. That's six more people who are fighting for the same amount of overhead bin space. And so they're going to be, it's the game of musical chairs. When the bins are full, that's it.
Yeah. And Scott, wouldn't there be for the airlines some costs then associated with setting up some kind of a system to weed out these overweight bags, let's say, some of the ones that probably shouldn't be on board anyway, that are now, you know, they're being checked at the gate in many cases, but if you're going to start charging people, does that create, you know, a whole new system that has to be set up and maybe some expense associated with that?
Well, yeah, and there have been different attempts at that. If you remember, airlines used to have those sort of metal templates over the X-ray machines, where if your bag was too big, it wouldn't go through. Mm-hmm. And TSA put an end to that. So the government's not going to be in the business of measuring bags for people. Airlines have tried. They'll have a couple agents roving in the terminal, stopping travelers, saying, that bag is too big for carry-on limits and things like that. Part of the problem is they've cut their staffing so thin that by the time you get to the gate and you get into the boarding process, there aren't people there to police baggage, and it's a very difficult thing. Who wants to pull three people out of line and say your bags are too big, and they're standing there saying that guy's bag is bigger than mine, and what about that woman over there? I mean, it's going to be arbitrary. And so it's a very difficult thing for the airline to police. It's also, one of the benefits for the airline is this has all made elite status more valuable. And airlines are always trying to find ways to cash in on things, taking credit card deals and saying, if you use this credit card, which the airline gets a piece of, then we'll waive the $25 first check bag fee for you, so you get that benefit. Or you reach elite level status at the airline and you get early boarding. Well, early boarding is now one of the prime benefits for elite level frequent flyers. You're less likely to get upgrades these days, but that ability to get on the airplane before everybody else and know that you're going to have overhead bin space has now become quite valuable.
Absolutely. Has there been any sort of passenger revolt over these carry-on charges from Spirit or anyone else who's doing it at this point?
Well, I think, some people fly Spirit and they're surprised. It's not just carry-on charges. Spirit has charges for everything you can imagine. If you want a window seat, you pay an extra fee. If you want a soft drink, you pay for that. Spirit's game is we want to advertise the lowest possible price, $59 or whatever, and then we're going to hit you up for another $59 or more in fees to get the price we need to cover the cost and make a profit. Spirit is really emulating Ryanair and EasyJet in Europe, it's a different model. It's a different way of doing business. Some people are surprised and are really put off by it. I'll never fly Spirit again, all that kind of stuff. Other people say, okay, well, I'll take the $59 fare, and I don't care if I have a middle seat, and I don't care if I'm not gonna travel with a whole lot of stuff, and I will get to where I want to go for a very cheap price, and they like that.
So the onus is really on the passenger to know exactly what they're getting for their money in the case of an airline like a Spirit.
Yeah, I mean, air travel has really become an a la carte pricing game. And so, it's like going to the restaurant, and some people want an appetizer and soup and drink and everything else, and some people don't. And so you do have the ability to sort of manage that. I think that's fine for add-on things. That's fine for extra comfort. I think people are quite understanding and happy to make the choice of whether they want to pay for extra legroom, for example. Mm-hmm. Give me something that I couldn't get before, and a lot of people will want to pay for that.
Yeah.
The problem with the checked bag is we don't travel naked, and you have to take stuff with you when you're going on a trip, and that has always been part of the equation. It's not just me and my seat, it's my bag as well. And so to charge extra for one suitcase really strikes people as being outrageous, almost like a hotel charging you extra for a bed.
Right, because those were costs that were baked in originally, and people just took for granted that I'm also buying space for a bag with my ticket.
Yeah, that's right, and I think understandably so. I think to my way of thinking, for the consumer, taking a bag with you is part of travel, and it ought to be part of the cost of the ticket.
Well, Scott, when we come back, we'll have our listeners join in our conversation, but we want to talk about lost bags because that's another pet peeve, and lots of other things, ticket prices, scheduling padding, we're seeing some of that, a merger in the works there, and lots of other things going on in the airlines. So when we come back, we'll talk about all that and more with Scott McCartney. He is a writer for the Wall Street Journal, travel writer, and we'd love to hear from you at 888-477-9499. We're talking about the airlines when Radio Times comes back.
The National Multiple Sclerosis Society supports WHYY and announces Bike MS City to Shore 2012. More than 7,000 cyclists of all ages and abilities will ride from Cherry Hill to Ocean City, New Jersey to help support a world free of MS. This ride is fully supported with catered rest stops, bike support, and SAG transportation. Cyclists can choose from a range of route options. To register, 800-455-BIKE or mscycling.org.
I'm Mike and Scott. In-depth news is important to you. That's why you listen to WHYY. It's the end of our fiscal year, and members have provided the support necessary to keep WHYY on the air. As we move into the new fiscal year, we need to hear from you. We'll continue to supply access to news and information, and you'll do your part now with a gift of support. Together, we'll keep WHYY strong. It takes just a moment when you give online at whyy.org. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Jed.
I'm Robert.
We make the show Radiolab,
which is mostly a show just for your ears.
But not anymore. Because coming soon to the Kimmel Center's Academy of Music...
A very different kind of Radiolab.
Yeah, eyeballs dancing.
Astronauts sizzling.
Holy cow.
Blind men yelling.
Sultan, you are trying to impose a visual totalitarianism upon the human brain.
Join us for Radiolab Live June 29th. Details are at radiolab.org/in the dark.
You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the airlines, getting an update on what's going on in the industry, talking about some recent customer satisfaction surveys that showed that customers weren't, in fact, so satisfied when it comes to some of the major airlines, and what passengers can expect as they travel this summer. We've been talking with Scott McCartney, who writes the Wall Street Journal's middle seat column. And Scott, we were talking about baggage fees. That's one of the big pet peeves that travelers have. But the other is lost bags. That's been an issue for a long time. I know there's been some improvement, but I was hearing recently that there is an effort underway by the Government Accountability Office to force the airlines to pay travelers if they lose their bags. Is that correct, and what's the status of that?
Well, the Department of Transportation has actually been pretty proactive under the Obama administration. In looking at passenger service issues, they did do baggage fees has been one area of concern. They did put through a measure, for example, that requires airlines to refund the baggage fee if they lose your bag. You had this situation where people would pay the fee, the bag wouldn't show up, and they'd say, you know, hey, you didn't deliver the bag, at least give me my fee back. And there were some airlines that were refusing to do that. Say, well, you get the bag back eventually. We didn't guarantee on-time delivery.
Wow.
So the government stepped in there. Governments have always looked at compensation for travelers whose bags are lost. There are international treaties about what's required. So I think this is sort of an extension of that, of looking at if you're without your bag for 24 hours, what's the airline's responsibility? And it's a tough issue. You're going to a meeting. Your suit is in the meeting. You got to have a suit for the meeting. What are you going to do? The airline says, well, we're going to get you your bag by 10 a.m., but you don't trust that they're going to actually do that, and that may be too late. And so, you know, do you go rent a suit, buy a suit? What do you do, and who should pay for that? And that's really the issue. Some airlines sort of voluntarily give you a toothbrush and toothpaste and, voucher for $25 or something and say, we'll call you. And the question is that really enough?
Yeah. Let me invite our listeners to join us. We're talking about the airlines, what's been going on in the industry, what are some of the things you can expect if you're planning to travel this summer. The number is 888-477-9499. And speaking of the phones, let's start off with Mark, and welcome Mark to Radio Times. Hi.
Hi, thanks very much for taking the call. My question relates to, you talked a little bit about the anxiety that people feel before getting on the plane to make sure that they can get their bag in the overhead bin. You talked about the premier status of, once you get upgraded in your status in the airline, one of the key benefits is getting on the plane earlier so you can get your bag on. Well, one of the points that I've made with many of my co-travelers is, why don't they assign the luggage bin above your seat to the owner of that seat?
Well, the simple answer, Mark, is there wouldn't be enough. For example, on American Airlines and some other airlines, there are now bins that have locks on them in the rear of the airplane for flight attendant bags. So the flight attendants have bags, and they've already put them up over the seats. And the people who sit in those seats don't have bins available over their seats. There are other bins that are taken up by emergency equipment, by medical kits or megaphones or different things like that. There are some seats that don't have bins directly overhead, sometimes in exit rows on larger airplanes or in bulkhead seats or things like that. So you add it all up and look at the space of the bin and say, okay, in that 30 inches of space we've allocated for the row of the seat, or 31 inches, can you get three bags in 31 inches of overhead bin space? And the answer is no.
Yeah. That is absolutely one of the big issues that, does generate anxiety. And of course, you know, Scott, to your point, the fact that more seats have been added makes even less room for the bags to go along. Let's talk a little bit about ticket prices. There was such a concern this spring with, you know, fuel prices being what they were, that there would be a real spike in airline ticket prices. How are prices right now? I know that fuel, at least for those of us who are driving, has come down somewhat. What's it like as far as ticket prices for the summer?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think it's really depending more on demand than anything else. Airlines certainly, if they can, are keeping prices at high levels. In different routes I've looked at, some prices are very high. I just yesterday was looking at some international routes where I was sort of surprised that prices for this summer weren't as high as we had expected. Probably more a reflection of the economy and demand. There may be more demand for domestic trips this summer. Instead of going to Europe, people may be keeping a tighter rein on the budget and therefore looking for trips closer to home.
Speaking of Europe, is there an Olympic effect at all as it relates to fares?
There was some early on. Certainly there was a lot of anticipation, and sometimes you get these situations where you have big events and airlines and hotels do the same thing, and everybody else anticipating really strong demand push prices up ahead of time. And then people look at it and say, gosh, you know, I'm not going to spend $2,000 to go to London. I'll go to Paris for $1,000, or I'll go somewhere else. And so those tickets don't sell. And I just yesterday looked at some, Chicago to London the first week of the Olympics, and the price was lower than it was back in February.
Really?
Yeah.
Surprising. We'll go back to the phone to Philly and welcome John to our conversation. Hi, John.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point that I think part of the reason the industry is going the way it is with the fees and all this and, like, the smaller seats is because we as the consumers have become so price-driven, like, online on Expedia.com or whatever. We don't care, like, about anything. Like, we don't care who the carrier is. We don't care about the stars. We don't care about this. So that just forces the carriers to become very price competitive. So they're trying to do whatever they can to be at the top of the Expedia list instead of thinking of what kind of value they could bring us.
Well, thanks for your call, John. Scott, what do you say?
Oh, I think that's yes, John's absolutely right. It's a big part of it. It's essentially a commodity business. You just want to get from point A to point B. A lot of people don't care which carrier they fly. And so they are just looking for the lowest price, and that is one of the games that's being played with all the fees, as we see with Spirit and everybody else, is hook people with the low price and then charge them more at the airport, rather than just rolling it all into the price of the ticket. I do think there are a lot of travelers out there who are willing to pay more for better service. They have to feel like they're getting better service. They are paying more for, say, economy plus seating on United, and we've seen a pretty strong trend towards, an improved economy cabin. In essence, airlines have driven people there because the regular coach cabin is sort of so spartan and so difficult for some people. That they feel like they have to pay more for enough room to put down the tray table and work on a laptop or not have their knees crammed into the seat in front of them. There are people willing to pay for first class upgrades. There are people willing to pay for business class on long haul trips. And I think, it's like any other business, giving consumers choices is a good thing.
Yeah. We'll go next to Hamilton and welcome Dwight to Radio Times. Hi, Dwight.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Your comment or question
just,
for Scott.
I was listening to you all, and I wanted to comment on what the last gentleman was saying about, the airlines giving you a low fee up front, and you get to the airport, find out you got to pay for this, you got to pay for your seat, you got to pay for a napkin, you got to pay for everything is, and then you wind up paying more than the competition rate that you projected initially. And I was just saying that, you know, a few times, you know, I felt as though I was tricked, you know, into flying. And in some cases, you know, my luggage, you know, going back to the first point, my luggage, you know, being lost, and I'm not being reimbursed. I'm kind of, you know, and I travel a lot on business, and a lot of times I don't have time. A lot of times when my flight is landing, I'm going from the airport straight to the hotel to freshen up and then straight to my event. So I don't even have enough time to go shopping
right.
In the case that my luggage was misplaced. And so there have been times when I had to literally wear what I wore on the plane to my event.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm an orator, so I have to speak in front of thousands of people in khakis and, you know, and a button-up shirt where, you know, when I plan to wear a suit.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is extreme inconvenience, I believe, when your luggage is misplaced. And it is almost absurd that, you know, the airlines don't have to, you know, take any responsibility
yeah.
for it. And I just wanted to, you know,
yeah.
I'll take my, you know, response off the air.
Well, thanks for your call, Dwight. And it sounds to me, Scott, like Dwight is articulating, you know, the frustrations of many passengers and some of the things that were pointed out in these customer sat surveys.
Yeah. But a couple of tips for Dwight. I always tell travelers, you really, if you need something for the next day, don't check it. Anything, and don't check jewelry, don't check anything valuable, don't check your iPad. You know, stuff gets stolen with pretty good regularity out of suitcases. But if you need, you know, whether it's medicine or clothing or whatever you need for the next day, you better take it in the overhead bin. And if you don't have elite status, one way you can improve your boarding overhead bin odds is by getting a seat in the back of the airplane. Because typically, airlines, back of the airplane gets you an earlier boarding group, and so you're on before. It's the people without elite status in the front of the airplane who are last to board and most in danger of not finding any overhead bin space. So take it with you and sit in the back of the plane, and you're more likely to get there with your stuff.
Good advice. Scott, let's talk a little bit about pending mergers. There's been a lot of publicity about U.S. Airways and American. What's the status of that?
Well, the status is complicated. There will be tomorrow a ruling from bankruptcy judge in New York on the status of American's labor contracts. That's part of the process. The labor unions have actually already, a very unusual step, but they have agreed in principle on contract terms with U.S. Airways management. They haven't agreed on anything with American Airlines management. So the unions have sort of cast their lot with U.S. Airways. American has until this fall the exclusive right to file a reorganization plan with the bankruptcy court. That gets evaluated by the creditors. They ultimately, you know, have the pull here with the bankruptcy judge. U.S. Airways can then bring in its plan, and the bankruptcy court will look at it and decide which is preferable.
And there was also the United Continental merger earlier, and from what I understand, that was kind of rough. There was not a smooth process. Have things smoothed out, and what were some of the issues around that?
Well, the real rough spot has been the computer integration. Other things have gone relatively well with that merger, although they still have labor issues. And this goes back to earlier this year in March when on one weekend United pulled the plug on its computer system essentially and moved it over to Continental's computer system for reservations and things like that. And it's been a fiasco. It's been reservations have been difficult to find. Seat assignments have disappeared. Upgrades, elite status, a lot of that stuff. Has really mucked up different flights, the boarding process, and customers have been outraged. Phone lines were jammed for hours and hours and hours when all this happened. I mean, you know, 12-hour waits on the phone, ridiculous. And part of the frustration for travelers was the airline was saying, oh, they're just small problems, it's not a big deal. It was a big deal to people. There were huge problems. We've reported a lot of this and still continue to hear from travelers who are having issues. There are still aspects of their system that aren't fully integrated yet. So this has been a really tough thing. It's slowed down their operations some. They've even, I think, taken flights out of the schedule to sort of deal with the reality of gate agents have had a tough time with the new system. A lot of the gate agents have said the training wasn't adequate for moving people who had used United system for years and years and years onto a completely new system. It's like learning a new foreign language, and that was part of the problem. It's an interesting contrast to the Delta Northwest merger, where Delta did its computer integration in four steps, very slowly, very methodically, very precisely. And there was hardly a hiccup, it seemed to go very well. It had been thought that Delta Northwest was sort of the blueprint for how to do a merger because it had gone well, but United tried to do it kind of the old-fashioned way, and it really blew up on them.
And wasn't there something about elite passengers being insulted? There was a remark about them being over-entitled or something to that effect?
Well, that's a bit of a different issue. As they've merged the airline, they've changed the terms of the frequent flyer program. So there were different benefits for United versus Continental passes, things that Continental gave you that United didn't give you, and vice versa. And so they've had to combine. And how do you deal with things like lifetime elite benefits? Do you grant those in the new system, and what are they? What does the lowest level elite frequent flyer get? The person who travels 25,000 miles a year, typically the lowest level of elite status at an airline, and for those people, the benefits have been cut some. The time that they how early they can reserve elite economy plus seats, for example, or whether they have to pay for economy plus seats. And so travelers have been some have gained in this, and a lot of people who have been quite vocal about it have lost status. Mm. And so at a industry conference, or actually it was a financial conference in New York, where the chief financial officer of United referred to the lowest level of frequent flyers as people who consider themselves over entitled, and that really set people off. That you know, these are people who spend a lot of money with the airline, who are very loyal to the airline, and to sort of diss them by calling them over entitled really infuriated them.
Scott, I'm going to stop you there because we need to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about bags, but this time how to pack them in the most efficient way. That and much more when Radio Times comes back.
Take Us Home supports WHYY. A group of Ethiopian Jews is waiting in Ethiopia for a chance for a new life in Israel. Many have waited for 10 years or more, living in mud huts with no water or electricity. Fukadeh and his wife are finally told that the wait for their family is over. But if they go, they must leave their adopted son, Worku, behind. Take Us Home is a new documentary film by Eileen LeBlanc, premiering at Philadelphia Independent Film Festival, Thursday, June 21st at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Chestnut Street.
On the next Fresh Air, Anne-Marie Slaughter talks about her new Atlantic Magazine cover story, Why Women Still Can't Have It All. She left her position as the State Department's Director of Policy Planning to spend more time with her children. She says if we truly believe in equal opportunity for all women, some things at the workplace and in society have to change. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. How did London win this summer's Olympics? Well, for one thing, they turned traffic lights green when visiting committee members drove up so they'd see no congestion. Also, rereading the classics, starting with Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage and The Razor's Edge. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about summer air travel. We're talking about the airline industry and what's been going on of late. And we've had with us as our guest Wall Street Journal Scott McCartney, who writes the paper's middle seat column. We also want to take a moment to check in with Doug Diamond for some advice on how to travel light wherever you're going this summer. Certainly, baggage has been a big issue for passengers, the fees and so on and so forth. Doug is a travel speaker and author of OneBag.com. Doug, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Tracy. Glad to be here.
So what do we need to know? What do we need to be thinking about as we're preparing for our trip before we even start packing?
Well, that's definitely the time to start thinking about it. Most people start their packing planning 5 minutes before they start putting things into their suitcase. So, the key issue is what you take, obviously. Most people take way too much stuff. And no wonder they have trouble getting it all into their bag and end up taking two or three bags. So plan ahead. Create a packing list for your personal lifestyle. Research it. Look into sources that will provide you information on how you can get things that are lighter and remove weight and bulk from what you're doing. And most people can travel indefinitely with what will fit in a small bag, small enough to carry on an airline. So unless you have some peculiar medical or structural problem, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to travel carry on in most instances, either for business or for pleasure. It's absolutely doable, but it does require a little investment of your time in thinking about what am I taking? Do I really need to take this? What kind of clothing works together? How can I make small numbers of clothing look like large numbers of clothing when I'm putting together outfits? How can I eliminate bulk and weight from my bag and on and on and on?
Well, I can imagine some listeners are shaking their heads and thinking, how in the world, you know, can I travel indefinitely on that one bag? But, Doug, I think that's an important thing for people to keep in mind that, you know, you can travel lighter. One of the problems is, you know, if you're going to a different climate, let's say, you're going somewhere far from home and you don't know quite how to pack, you're anticipating any number of possibilities weather-wise, that creates some concerns.
It does, but the way to solve them is by looking into it and knowing how people have done this in the past. Weather issues are pretty straightforward. You understand the concept of layering instead of taking giant coats and big raincoats and umbrellas and all of that sort of thing. I mean, I've quite regularly traveled from cold, rainy climates to 125-degree temperatures in India in the same two-week trip, on a business trip, with my laptop, business clothing, all that sort of thing, and I still managed to do it with my single carry-on bag. So it's absolutely possible to do this. It's the thing that travel writers for more than 2,000 years have been telling people to do, but it does seem to be the thing that people find the most difficult to accomplish themselves.
Huh. So, Doug, what is the most efficient way to pack? If we're talking about that carry-on that should fit in the overhead bin on the plane, what's the most efficient way for us to pack that bag?
Well, the key is not to put too much in it. I mean, that's the main issue. The main issue is not how you actually put the things in the bag. It's not putting too much stuff in the bag. There are certainly tricks to packing. Things like using otherwise unused space, such as the insides of shoes and things like that. There are ways to pack clothing so that you're not folding it and causing it to get creases and wrinkles. So there are tricks that make the packing itself be a little more efficient and definitely more practical for daily use. But there's not a lot of real trickery in what goes in the bag. The trickery is in knowing what to put in the bag.
Well, and you talked about folding clothes in such a way that they don't wrinkle. And I know a lot of us are interested in knowing, how does that work? What do you recommend?
It's not an easy thing to explain over the radio. It's something you need to see, but imagine this. Clothing wrinkles because of shifting fabrics. Clothing creases because you have folded and are applying pressure to those folds. So the secret is essentially to wrap the clothing around something. So imagine a small pillow, for example. That's probably not what you would use, but imagine a small pillow and think of gently but firmly wrapping the clothes around the pillow so that there are no folds and therefore there are no creases.
Hmm. Well, and what about rolling? Because that's certainly been kind of conventional wisdom that rolling items up helps create more space. Is that a good idea?
Nope. That's one of those old wives' tales that masks itself as conventional wisdom. I mean, imagine taking a dress shirt and rolling it up and putting it in your suitcase and then arriving at the other end and going to a business meeting with it. I mean, it just doesn't make sense at all. But yeah, it works great for T-shirts because T-shirts don't wrinkle anyway. So, and most of the people who are offering that as advice, that's what they're packing, T-shirts.
I'm thinking about women here, Doug, and, mm-hmm. you know, toiletries and that kind of thing. I mean, maybe perhaps men don't have to carry as much in that regard, but I know for women, you know, we have to have all of our makeup and so on and so forth. Any advice for women who are trying to bring along all of those necessities in terms of efficient ways to pack them and what to be thinking about?
Sure. I mean, the obvious first response is don't bring so much stuff. Think about ways of cutting down the list of toiletries and cosmetics that you carry.
Yeah. But, you're talking to women here, Dan.
I know. But there is one step you can take that can make a really significant difference in that regard, and that is to realize that a vast number of cosmetics and toiletries are comprised mostly of water, and water is just about the worst thing to pack in your bag with you. It's heavy, it's bulky, it leaks, it causes consternation among the security people, and most of these things, soaps, shampoos, mascaras, moisturizers, insect repellents, sunscreens, on and on and on. Most of those things, with very few exceptions, you can find in solid form, which will take up less space, weigh a great deal less, and be a lot more pleasant to haul around with you.
I'm thinking of one other thing, too, and this is for women and men, but probably more for women, and that's shoes and the best way to pack those. I know that, you know, most suitcases will have little compartments that you can maybe slide one or two pairs of shoes into, but any recommendations on that?
Generally, most people can get by with a couple of pairs of shoes, dress shoes and walking shoes or casual shoes. People who need more shoes for dress-up occasions should put a little thought into maybe how they can reduce the total quantity. Women get away with that a little more than men because their shoes tend to be less structured and smaller and take up less space. But the real secret there is just to learn to live without five pairs of shoes on the road.
That could be a tall order for some people, Doug. I'm just saying.
Well, I know.
Well, the overall advice, it sounds like, is less really is more, especially when it comes to, you know, packing these carry-ons and trying to get as much use out of them as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, there are huge benefits to this. Security, the fact that you don't have to give your belongings away to someone, it's much cheaper, as you've already been talking about on the show. The mobility that it gives you, the flexibility to change your travel plans if your plane is delayed or if a flight is canceled, all of those things are only available to people who are traveling lightly, not people whose baggage is being held hostage by the airlines. Mm. It's also just a lot more comfortable, and it's also a much better way to treat the planet Earth and not hauling all this stuff around with you.
Well, Doug Diamond, we want to thank you for taking some time to school us and educate us on how best to prepare for these trips. And if people want more information, we can send them to onebag.com, correct?
That's right.
Okay, well, thank you again for being with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Tracy. Bye-bye.
So we're talking about the airline industry and not only what's been happening, but, you know, how to get ready for summer travel. Many of us will be taking off on airplanes throughout the summer. We have also been talking with The Wall Street Journal's Scott McCartney, who writes the paper's middle seat column. And Scott, when we left off, we were talking about some of the trends that we're seeing in the airlines. Now that we know how to pack, we were talking about...
I can add one packing tip.
Oh, very good. By all means.
Pick a color scheme. So it makes a huge difference. Yeah. If you limit yourself to blue for a trip, then you can really cut down on the number of shoes you need but you don't want to take a blue suit, you don't, and a brown suit, just stick with blue or brown or whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's a great idea because it certainly minimizes the shoes and everything else if you can mix and match a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were talking about a lot of these different trends, and we left off, we were talking about mergers, but there was something unusual that we came across, and that is relating to Delta, kind of getting into the oil refining business. We hear that, you know, locally in our area that they are planning to buy the Sunoco refinery, or the ConocoPhillips refinery, to reduce fuel costs, for themselves and maybe preserve some jobs here locally. Is that unusual for an airline to get into that part of the business?
Yeah, it's highly unusual, and I think quite a fascinating development. One of the complaints that airlines have had about fuel prices is that the cost of refining jet fuel has really gone up faster than the cost to refine other fuels. So there's a bigger gap there in the refining process that they're paying extra for. Now, jet fuel is not as heavily used as gasoline or even heating oil or things like that. So it may be, a higher cost item for refineries to begin with, and so Delta's response has been, well, let's buy a refinery, and then we can pay ourselves the margin or reduce the margin for us and maybe for other airlines who want to buy jet fuel from us as well. It's sort of the ultimate fuel hedge that if airlines are losing money and refineries are making money, then Delta's on both sides of that equation instead of just being on the losing side of it.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a throwback. Airlines have struggled for decades and how to find a way to make money. It's very difficult to make money moving people. I don't think it's ever been successfully done in history. Stagecoaches or railroads or ocean liners or you name it, it's extremely difficult to move people for money. Back to the point that John made, which is absolutely right. This is people just shop for the lowest price. But in the old days, airlines sort of tried to find hedges by buying hotel chains and rental car companies, and we're going to provide the entire travel experience. And different airlines have tried different things, none of which has really worked. They ultimately come back and say, we don't really know how to run a hotel company or a rental car company. We're going to stick to our core business, which is airlines. May ultimately be what happens with Delta with this.
Yeah. There were some concerns, too. One of the pet peeves that I've been hearing about is changes to family boarding, where we've kind of taken it for granted that families would board together, perhaps even board ahead of time. And there have been some changes with some of the airlines, correct?
Well, yeah. The days of when families got to board first have been gone for a while. Some airlines move families into sort of middle or kind of earlier boarding groups, but it's the first class people, the ultra elite people who get on first before families. The real issue with families is not so much boarding but seating, and so we've gotten into this situation where several airlines have basically left only the dregs of the airplane for free seat assignments. And if you want a decent seat, a window seat, an aisle seat, or whatever, you're going to have to pay extra for that. And so the notion is, if you're a family and you go and you look, and the only seats available to reserve for free are middle seats scattered throughout the airplane, how are you going to sit together? Unless you're forced to pay, $10, $15, $20 for seat assignments, add that up to four people, all of a sudden you've got an extra $80. That you have to pay each way simply to sit together. And so that's the issue that's really sort of outraged people. It's interesting. I was up at Air Canada years ago. They were the really sort of the pioneer of a lot of a la carte pricing. And they talked about how families would be among their target customers for seat fees because people would want to sit together.
Wow.
And so this is sort of, it's a calculated move on airlines to say, who's going to pay extra to sit together? Well, families are, but people have reacted as saying, that's quite unfair.
Well, especially when you think about families with young children, Scott. Not so bad if they're teenagers and they really don't want to sit with you anyway.
Yeah,
but
no,
younger.
It's a real problem. I did a story about this a while ago, people who were separated from their 3-year-old and 4-year-old, it's terrifying. That you're going to sit, for 5 hours, plop your child in between two strangers.
Yeah.
And so it's a real issue. I think for the most part, travelers are quite willing to accommodate families on the airplane, But, you know, who wants to go around negotiating seat swaps?
Yeah. I want to ask you one last thing, and that is about some of the regional airports and how they've been struggling with scheduling changes, with the airlines cutting back on some of those flights, and now some passengers are having a hard time, or at least a long time, getting from one point to another if they have to use a regional carrier as part of their trip.
Well, this has been a problem for a long time, and it's really the supply and demand issue. Small towns want lots of air service and convenient air service, but if they don't have the population, if they don't have the traffic to support that, it's really hard to expect airlines to run unprofitable flights in there. And so it gets more difficult. If the population is declining, the air service is going to decline as well.
Yeah, and then that creates for, you know, some long trips for some folks, but it's all, I guess, part of this, you know, cost-cutting and greater efficiency movement that the airlines are doing.
From a small town, you can get to a major hub almost always nonstop. So it may be a question of, I have to go to a hub in the wrong direction. To where I want to go, or I'm going to have a longer layover in the hub. I think people have gotten to the point where they don't mind long layovers as much. It takes out some of the anxiety of I don't want to miss the connection. Gives me time to get some food because I'm not going to get any food on the airplane.
Right.
There are lots of reasons. Your bag is more likely to show up if you have a long layover than a tight connection. So there are plenty of savvy travelers who will book long layovers to begin with, just for the comfort and assurance of that.
In some cases, it makes a lot of sense. We've been talking with Wall Street Journal travel editor Scott McCartney, who writes the paper's middle seat column. Scott, thank you so much for just keeping us up to speed on what the airlines are doing and helping us understand what we as travelers need to be thinking about before we get on the plane. Thanks for being with us, and happy travels to you this summer.
And to you too, Tracy. Thanks very much.
Great having you with us. You've been listening to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.